Hello, everybody, and welcome back. I am so happy to be here with all of you. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I had the summer off. I wasn't really off since I was working full time with my husband in our family business, where we do architectural metal and glass, which is a different type of job than what I normally do in my food world. So it was really, it's really been wonderful working with him, but I have missed this radio show and my newsletter and all of you out there who check in every week and listen to me. So I'm really happy to be back. Thank you. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. Christina Grace will be my guest. She is the CEO and founder of Foodprint, which is a wonderful organization helping businesses become more conscious of their food waste and how they can reduce that. And so we'll be talking more, and I'll tell you more about Christine in just a little bit. But first, I want to just talk to you about my summer and what's going on in the news, and of course, share a recipe with all of you. So this summer in the garden was really quite exceptional. I had the widest spread of interns I've ever had. I had a 14-year-old young man who is going to be a freshman in high school. And I've never taken on anyone that age before, but he requested it actually through his father. And I said, sure, why not, if he was interested. And he was just so delightful, and he really enjoyed learning from us. Excellent. He was the only guy. And then we had three other interns, two college age students, and then one older woman who is more of my age. And so I had a span from 14 to 62. And it was just really wonderful to have that kind of perspective from young to old and or elder, not quite old yet. And it was just delightful, and we grew so many beautiful things. I put some pictures in my newsletter this week, but the green beans were unbelievable. I had red and white onions, potatoes, tomatoes, of course, basil. And my peach tree this year, the last few years, my peach tree did not produce much. This year, my peach tree was unbelievable. I got, I'd say, four laundry baskets full of peaches, just so many. And it took hours and hours of processing them. I blanched them all, peeled them all, sliced them up, and put them into, measured out 6 cups and put them into the freezer. So I have the right amount for making a cobbler or a pie at any time during the year. I can just pull out a bag, but it's unbelievable how many pounds of peaches I got. I still have corn growing out there. I have all my greens still growing, broccoli rabe, broccoli, collards, kale, Swiss chard. I made lots of pesto, but I have lots more of pesto to make. And so it's just been a wonderful, wonderful summer. And we also started renovation in my kitchen, which I've talked about over the years. We planned a big renovation, and with COVID happening and finances and stuff, we scaled it back. We're working just within the framework of the current kitchen. We're not breaking down any walls, but I'm getting all new cabinets, new floor, and I'm really excited. For those of you who have had the pleasure of working with me when I feed the homeless for Thanksgiving, you know how much my kitchen needed a renovation. Literally, the cabinets were falling apart. So I'm really excited about that. So many things are going on in and around the news. When you take a summer off, so many things happen during that time. And at the same time, so many things are the same. And it was just really nice to take a break from, you know, sending out the petitions for the pipelines and the chlorpyrifos and the pesticides and the recycling and the plastic waste. And I mean, unfortunately, it's all still here. 3 months later, not much has changed. Although we do have a ban on chlorpyrifos, which is really, really exciting. This is something that we've been fighting with for decades. We thought it finally was going to get banned back in 2016, and then you know who was elected, and all that went out the window. So finally, the Environmental Protection Agency, which has been doing a really, was doing a really bad job under the prior administration, is back to actually maybe doing some work. So I'm really excited about that. It actually, this few weeks ago, the federal government announced that they will have a new office for climate change, health, and equity. And that's going to be out of the Department of Health and Human Services. And that's really exciting because for the first time, our government is actually going to take it up as a issue that is so important. I mean, we're seeing the wildfires just continuing to take over hundreds and thousands of acres of land out in the West. We have droughts and hurricanes and floods and tornadoes, and the weather is just absolutely crazy. And we know it's related to climate change. Our food system, we saw how fragile our food system is during this pandemic. And we also saw how those with a lower income were definitely more affected by the pandemic. And we realize as a nation that how you eat affects your health, and we need to put more and more emphasis on that. We'll be talking about that certainly more today as I get into my conversation with Christina. Food stamps also got their largest increase in history, which is really exciting, 25% increase. You know, when you look at the numbers, it still is a ridiculously low amount for someone to actually purchase food for a whole month on that amount. I think it comes out to like $150 per person for a month's worth of food. And for those of you that have gone shopping for some healthy food lately, you know that that's not a lot. But there are a lot of extra programs that people can plug in with, like Double Up Your Bucks, where people who are on the SNAP program, also known as the food stamp program, they actually can purchase twice as many vegetables at a farm stand for, you know, let's say they spend a dollar, they can get $2 worth of produce. It's really a great program. And so Double Up Your Bucks is happening right now here on Long Island. And I know there's lots of programs like that going around. We also have been feeding our children during the pandemic free of charge in the school lunch program. And that is really great. As a, you know, a former farm to school coordinator, I should say that my job at Glen Cove Public School has not come back since the pandemic, and I don't know if it will. But feeding all the kids free of charge is a game changer for so many people. The stigma that has been around kids who get free and reduced lunch has been there since I was a kid in school, and so. So many choose not to eat rather than have to pull out that card and swipe it. And so the fact that everyone's on the level playing field and everyone is entitled to, you know, a breakfast and lunch at school is really great. Now we just have to work on making those meals a little bit healthier. I know, you know, a lot has been done about reducing salt and sugar and fat, but not enough has been done. And also what happened when they took a lot of the fat out, they increased the sugar. And so that's really not good. So we need to work on getting more fresh vegetables into the school lunch program. And I will continue to do that because, as you know, that is my passion. But meanwhile, at least we are feeding our children. And that is so important. You cannot learn if your stomach's growling, if you're hungry. All you can think about is eating and you can't focus on the lessons. And so this is really great news. We need to push for this program to continue. The Universal School Lunch Program needs to get everyone's support. And there's actually a bill that's happening right now, and I have a petition on my website to let Congress know that you support the Universal School Meals Program Act of 2021. And that will continue to give free food to our children in school. And that is a game changer for so many people. I know, you know, there's a lot of people that don't think the school lunch programs that important because their kids don't use it because they pack lunch. Well, not everyone has that luxury and can afford to pack lunch for their children. And so this is really an essential lifeline for so many people. So I want to share a recipe with you. I made so many recipes over the summer, but another thing that I took a break from is turning them into recipes all summer long. It was just a pleasure to just cook and, you know, have people cook with me and eat and not stop every 5 minutes taking pictures. So this is one recipe I did make though, and it is just delicious. I have made vegan spanico pizza before, but I'm constantly improving on it. And the one thing I did this time was add a little bit of cashew cream to actually bring in a little bit of the richness and creaminess that feta cheese normally gives to a spanico pizza. So this is really great. And also spanico pizza, just so you know, is known as spinach pie. I didn't use any spinach because those of us in the garden know that spinach is an early spring crop. And so I had no spinach in the garden at this time. I'm actually just planting new spinach now for the fall. But I used all the different greens that I had. I used Swiss chard, collard, kale, some broccoli rabe, really any greens you can use to make a spanico pizza. And actually using the darker leafy greens makes it even a richer dish. So it was really great. I buy Philo factory Philo dough. It's organic and it's a great brand. A lot of the other brands that you will find in the stores have a preservative in it. So do look for the Philo factory Philo dough, which is organic and has no preservatives. You want about 3 pounds of assorted greens. And I measure, it's actually 3 pounds prior to cooking it. So it's really a lot, big bowls worth. And you want to wilt your greens before you actually put them into the recipe. And you can do that either by just blanching them in water and then putting them into an ice bath, or you can steam them. But at one, however you wilt them, when you're finished, you do want to put them into a ice bath just to lock in the color so that it's a bright green color and doesn't turn that olive green color. Because those of us that are chefs know that people eat with their eyes before they even taste it. So how things look is really, really important. You're going to use 2 pounds of extra firm tofu that you're going to cut into small 1/4-inch cubes, 1 big bunch of dill, 2 onions chopped, 1 teaspoon salt and 1 teaspoon pepper, 2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast, 2 cups of cashews that you are going to soak for a couple hours. However, if you have a Vitamix, soaking it is not as important. But if you're going to use your food processor, you want to soak it for 2 hours so that it really blends up well. 3 handfuls of organic white rice. You can use a jasmine rice or a basmati rice. You can't use brown rice in this dish really because it won't cook all the way through. I tried using brown rice one time and I had hard pieces of rice in the dish. So use a white rice that cooks a little faster, or put in partially already cooked brown rice. But the idea about the rice, actually that won't work. The idea about the rice is that the rice will absorb the extra water in the spinach pie, and it will use that water to cook itself so that the spinach pie is not watery. So that's the purpose of the raw rice that's going to go into the dish. So you're going to start by placing the tofu cubes in a bowl, toss it with 1/2 cup of olive oil, add 1 tablespoon of dried dill, or if you have enough fresh dill, you can certainly add fresh dill instead. 1 teaspoon of salt and 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, and toss it and let that marinate for 1/2 hour. And that's going to bring some fat into the tofu and have it taste a little bit more like feta cheese in the dish. After it's marinated, you're going to bake that tofu in a 375 oven just for about 15 minutes until all of the little cubes start getting golden brown. You know, that's just going to crispen up the edge so it won't fall apart, and it also will lock in a lot of that flavor. You're going to steam all the greens until they're soft and wilted, and then you're going to put them into the ice bath to lock in that flavor and color. Drain the greens, and then you're going to squeeze out all of the water by the handful. And even though you're squeezing all the water out, like I said, you're still going to be putting in raw rice to absorb any extra water. But this is a great exercise. Take a handful of those greens and just squeeze them really hard into the sink and get rid of the water, and then put the greens into a bowl. You're going to do a large bowl because you're going to mix all the different ingredients together in this bowl. Meanwhile, you're going to saute the onions in some olive oil until they're translucent and starting to caramelize. And then you can add them to the bowl with all of the greens. And the greens, I didn't say, you actually want to chop up the greens really fine so that when people are eating the spinach pie, they can actually cut into it and don't have to get a long piece of Swiss chard or something like that. So you're going to chop that up the greens really well. You're going to drain the cashews and pulse them in your food processor with 1.5 cups of water, 2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast, and another teaspoon of salt and 1/2 teaspoon of pepper. And pulse that until it's really smooth. And just, you know, pulse it, and then let it run for a while until it's really smooth. You're going to add that cashew cream along with the dill and the tofu cubes to the bowl of greens and mix that up really well. And then add those 3 handfuls of white rice to that dish and mix it up. You're going to pour 1 cup of olive oil into a small bowl. And you're going to use a paintbrush, a 2-inch or 2.5-inch paintbrush. But you can use a pastry brush, but using a wide paintbrush actually makes it go faster. And when you're working with phyllo dough, you really want to work it fast so that the phyllo dough doesn't dry up. In a package of phyllo dough, there's about 20 sheets of phyllo pastry. So you're going to put 10 of those sheets on the bottom and 10 of them on the top. If the phyllo sheets are too big for your pan, you can trim the phyllo sheets as one chunk. Usually I trim off about 1 inch on the side of the phyllo pastry going down the long side so that it fits onto the pan better. Spray the bottom of a pan with an oil, olive oil, canola oil, avocado oil, whatever spray you have, or you can just brush on some oil, but you want to oil the pan before you put in your first sheet of phyllo pastry. Put in 1 sheet of phyllo pastry, then you're going to brush it with some of the olive oil. Not too heavy, just, you know, a light coating of olive oil. If you have a spray bottle, you can use a spray bottle also for this. But you don't want to use one of those spray bottles that that are under pressure. You know, it's just only if you have your own little spray bottle, you can use that. And then you're going to brush on the olive oil and keep repeating that until 10 sheets of phyllo pastry are on the bottom. So phyllo pastry, brush it with olive oil. Phyllo pastry, brush it with olive oil. Go until you have 10 sheets down. Then you're going to pour that filling into the lasagna pan where you're putting the phyllo pastry and even it out so that you have the spinach mixture, green mixture, evenly distributed all over. And then you're going to repeat the phyllo dough on the top. Put a sheet of phyllo pastry down. Brush some olive oil on it and keep going until you've used up all of the phyllo pastry. And on the top sheet, you want to brush it and make sure that there's olive oil everywhere. Then you are going to score through the top of the spinach pie with a knife and cut the pieces of phyllo pastry. You don't need to cut it all the way through, but you do want to score it so that when it's cooked and you go to cut it, you're not cutting through the phyllo for the first time, and because it will just crumble and it will look messy. So by cutting it when it's solid together with the olive oil before it's cooked, you can get really nice cuts. And then you're going to bake it in an oven. You're going to bake it for 375 at a 375 degree oven for about 15 minutes until it's golden brown. And my oven's hotter in the back, so halfway through I always turn the pan around. And that's it. I know you're going to love it, enjoy it. And I always love feedback. So when you get a chance, let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Christina Grace. Christina is the founder and CEO of Foodprint, which is a design, training, and technology business. Foodprint helps companies eliminate waste using thoughtful space design, best people practices, a 20-year expert in sustainable food systems, and a trained cook. And she's based in Brooklyn. She spent her career managing projects that drive economic development, address public health, and mitigate climate change through a more sustainable food system. Before launching Foodprint, Christina managed the Urban Food Systems Program for the New York State Department of Agriculture, where she supported regional farm-to-market, farm-to-school, and urban agricultural initiatives. And so it's my pleasure to introduce you all to Christina. Christina, are you with me?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I had to unmute. I am here in Brooklyn where there is constant traffic.
Well, I'm glad you're there.
So nice to be here.
My computer connection is a little funny. So if we get disconnected, we'll come right back. But anyway, there you are. Okay. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm good too. Thanks. So I wanted to ask you first to just give us a little bit more history about how did you follow your career to be interested in food to start with?
Well, you know, I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts where we had a garden that was about an acre. So I grew up canning vegetables and eating zucchini out of the bucket freezer all winter long. So there was always cooking in my home and baking. So food has been, and we're very deep in our family culture of making Swedish cookies and Greek dolmas and things that come from our heritage. So I grew up that way. And then I went off to school in Boston, and I, with all of my student loans, did what most people do. I graduated and got a job that would pay the bills. I spent 10 years in high-tech marketing and kind of woke up one day and said, whoa, I studied political economy. My thesis was on the Green Revolution in Peru and how devastating that was to agriculture. I studied all these things that I was very passionate about. And then there I was doing fun work, but it wasn't my dream. So I left and went to culinary school just at the time where the local food buzz was happening around. Suddenly there was cheese coming out of Vermont and farmers markets popping up and things that, and it seemed like I could be part of that movement. But I graduated from culinary school just in time to move to Portland, Oregon. And if you want to go anywhere and be immersed in the food system, I recommend you show up in Portland. I ended up running a farmer's market as a part-time in my neighborhood as a resident, as a part-time thing while I was still working in high tech, as a consultant, and immediately was pulled into all of the, okay, how do we get more food stamp clients coming to the farmers market? How do we connect regional farmers with more opportunities to sell their food in the city? And I got to do some, I got involved because I had done marketing and market research, some very cool projects. We got funding from Kaiser to do a really great study on how to get food stamp customers to urban farmers markets. And that went really well and it got published in the Journal of Environmental Nutrition, and that just opened a door to other projects. I had a big project in California that ended up being a massive market research program to understand what it would take to have a sustainable food system in California, where I got to interview people from all parts of the food sector, from fishermen and farmers to massive distributors, the regional head of Whole Foods, UNFI distributor, VP, and university folks who were working on these issues. And I just got sucked in and loved the work. And there just seemed like there were so many things to solve. That when I got to New York and I got the job at the state, I kind of had found my, I was working in my passion, which was really wonderful. And, I started Foodprint in 2017 because so much of my work here in New York City had started to move to solving for food waste. You and I met when I was working on a lot of farm to school issues, farm to institution, urban agriculture, and all of the urban ag work had made me one of the handful of people that understood composting in New York City, which, you know, when New York City had their organics ban and they said, no, we can't put food waste in the landfill anymore, back in 2014, businesses didn't know what to do. And I was hired by a company that was really thinking about, they were building a new development. It was related companies. They were building a new development on the west side of the city and said, we're going to have a lot of food waste. We have to plan for this. We've never thought about this before. And I said, you know, I know nothing about big developments. I know nothing about planning for food waste. And they said, but nobody does, and you know enough. And that project ended up being the kernel for the company I'm running now, where we started working with them. And then we took that knowledge of really understanding, like, how do you think about waste in food places and design, and how do you plan for to make sure it gets composted, it has beneficial reuse, and, you know, how do food businesses, you know, we were working for a company that had resources, but we were looking around the city of New York going, oh my gosh, you know, there are all of these small restaurants and groups that they're just no resources for that, for thinking about how we look at food waste and other waste differently. So again, that was the kernel for a food print and have been at it ever since. And, you know, I've never left. I may not be doing farm to school work at the moment, but I'm still a policy advocate and I'm still immersed. I'm a parent of kids in public school, so I'm engaged. And still very involved in other policies around food issues. So that's, you know, that's how I got here. Very long.
You know, and like I said in my introduction, I mean, Well, as I had said in my introduction, you know, the school lunch program is so important for so many kids. You know, and yet there's still so much work to do to make that school lunch program healthy. It's just, I'm sure you're experiencing it with kids in public school. My kids are now out, but, you know, it was like one step forward, two steps back constantly. And it was unbelievably frustrating.
And, you know, we put so much pressure on the people on the ground in the schools who actually produce the food when they're asked to do so much with so little funding. It's such an important program. And it is the primary food source for so many kids. And it takes money. It takes, when we think about what you could buy for, you know, $2 to $3 for a meal, not much. And even with, you know, the buying power.
They don't even get that much. You know, I mean, not only the food has to come out of it, but the labor has to come out of it.
Everything has to come out of it. And, you know, you have, and it's different from place to, I mean, everyone gets the same federal money, but some cities and towns contribute, some, you know, some counties and some don't. And, you know, so it's certainly not the same everywhere. And it's incredibly frustrating. And at the federal level, there should be so much more funding coming to it because it works. It really does work. And we saw with COVID, like you said,
these
food service teams mobilized. They were feeding not just students, but other hungry people in communities. They used their summer meal networks, and it was just amazing to see how, I don't know what families would have done without those resources, because the emergency food networks are not as, they're just not as resourced, frankly, as the school meals program.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was very disappointed, you know, the school I was working in, you know, I was in charge of increasing fresh vegetables into the lunch program. And I was going to six of the district schools. They panicked and they just needed to use up the food that they had in the freezer. And they just, anything fresh went right out the window. They just like cut me immediately. And, you know, I worked with them just to they started a food pantry to just help a lot of the families. Because one of the reasons we got the grant for my has so many free and reduced kids in the district. So the need was great and they just didn't have the bandwidth to keep the program going at this time. Maybe they'll bring it back, but
I hope anyway, they bring it back, because we know that when there's a point person, when there is someone who's thinking about this 24/7, because it's not just bringing the vegetables in, right? It's all the accompanying education. It's getting the kids excited about them. It's integrating it into the curriculum, all those things that requires resources if we want it to really work. And you need a person right. who's just thinking about it at every school, not in every district, but at every school.
Right. Absolutely. So with your 20 years experience working on all these food issues and food systems from farm to compost, what do you see as the most pressing fact about our food system that every person should know?
There's so many. In my world right now, we talk about food waste all of the time because it is really the number one, you know, when Drawdown, which is a fabulous, if you haven't read Drawdown, read it, but it's a global initiative to really reverse climate change. All these scientists have gotten together and they've come up with the changes that have to happen, and obviously not overnight, but when they came out with the first edition of the top interventions, reducing food waste was number three, and then they revised it and food waste became number one in terms of the problem and solution. We waste between 30% and 40% of the food grown globally from farm to plate. And that is just staggering. Like, that is food that should be eaten that is wasted. In transport, it's wasted. Some of it never leaves right. the farm, and a lot of it's wasted here at home. And most of it's wasted in our retail places and at home. So really thinking about how to reduce that, because what we also know is when food waste gets tossed in the trash and it goes to landfill, it creates methane, which is much more powerful than carbon dioxide in terms of a greenhouse gas negative impacts. And so, right. so that's. You know, the biggest thing, but honestly, as a human, you know, I work on sustainability issues. Yes, I love the planet, but I don't see the planet as separate from us. And so when I came into this work, the thing that was most compelling to me was public health and how, if we're going to live on this planet and we're going to live long and good lives, we need to have access to healthy food. We need to have access to clean air. There needs to have access to good drinking water, all these things. And we can't have public health without a healthy environment, a healthy planet. But when we talk about what affects people's public health most in this country when it comes to the food system, is the fact that, you know, 14% of our workforce is employed in the food system. That's one out of every seven workers in the nation's workforce work in some part, from farming to meat processing plants to restaurants to hospitalities. It is the worst paying industry as a whole. You have so many people that aren't getting benefits. You have so many workers in the food system on food stamps. It's ironic and it's horrible. And so I feel like all of these things have to be fixed. But I think, you know, I spend my time talking to people about plastics in the ocean and all these things as a company working on waste. But from a personal perspective, I feel like if we can't take care of our people, how are we going to get people to think about plastic, right? How are we going to even, if we can't take care of people first, like, what do we do? So I think really thinking about minimum wage and benefits and COVID, gosh, you know, who are our essential workers during COVID? Either the hospital workers or the people at the grocery store, the people at the restaurant serving us food. And these were people that were risking their lives. They were out working together before we really even knew how to manage COVID. And so many people were lost. So many people here in New York in the food world, you know, died from COVID. And so I think it's something for us to ask ourselves, if we can label someone an essential worker, should we really pay them $10 an hour and no healthcare? You know, is that really acceptable? So I think that's where I would start.
Yeah.
I know in our world of,
right.
you know, in our world of waste, food waste, and then plastics. And microplastics, when you know, the sheer amount of plastic waste and how that has grown.
Yeah. Right? And also, you know, the thing I like to. Yeah. Also, you know, when we talk about food waste, for people to actually understand that the waste is not only in the food, it's all the resources that went into making up the food. I know you touched on the transportation and the soil, and, you know, most of the food is not organic. So it's all the pesticides and herbicides that get sprayed all over the place that were, you know, not only costly for the farmer, but horrible for our environment, that with waste. So there's just so many aspects of the waste.
So many. And most of the waste happens at the end of the chain, but most of the carbon, those greenhouse terrible impacts happen early in the chain. Like you said, the fertilizer and the pesticides, and I mean the water that goes into growing food, and so when we're sitting there holding something in our refrigerator, we're like, is it good enough to eat? Or we're reading a label on milk, but we're not smelling it. You know, we're doing these things and we're getting ready to throw something away. We need to sort of step back and be like, does it really need to be thrown away? Can we do something with this?
Right.
And I think in the world where you're doing
So I know when. I'm sorry, what was that?
Oh, I was going to say in your world, where you're providing people really wonderful recipes on your show. I think really fun to be looking at, you know, the recipes for things that people consider waste, you know, the kale stems and, you know, what when we're juicing. Don't get a juicer that removes all the fiber, you know, stick it in the blender, you know, things, simple things that reduce waste so much. And it's a fun exercise while cooking.
Yeah. One of my favorite recipes is trying to figure out how to use some of the parts of the vegetable that I didn't used to use. You know, I use all the beet tops and the, you know, turnip tops and all those tops that we used to just trash or put in the compost, you know, is great food now. So I really enjoy that. So when we were talking, you were actually saying you actually have some optimism when you look at what's going on in New York. Can you share with us what is making you feel optimistic in New York right now?
Well,
Yeah,
I'm very optimistic about grassroots work in New York and always have been. You know, we have 400 farmers markets and those exist because communities kind of step up and say they want it and farmers are willing to come. But that there's favorable policy, you know, whether it's the banning food waste from landfill so that businesses have to separate and compost it. I mean, I'm hoping that at some point we'll have a residential ban on organics to landfill. So individuals have to separate out their food waste and start to learn about what they're wasting and how they can reduce that. There's fabulous policies. You know, we talked about COVID and the need for food. I mean, New York for the longest time has had favorable Good Samaritan legislation in place to support food donations, to get businesses to donate surplus food. And of course, at the federal level, we have those. Businesses are very protected. And we saw so many cool things during the worst of COVID where funding organizations stepped up, like Robin Hood stepped up and funded a fabulous program that that allowed restaurants to get paid to actually produce food for the donation system. And it was a way to keep people employed and feed hungry people. And I think looking at how, you know, in the worst of the worst around COVID, there was innovation to kind of handle those problems. But like I said, I feel like we're an agricultural state with the largest city in the country. So we have a lot of opportunities in terms of a massive market and so much food produced here. And as we see the challenges, obviously, of climate change, and, you know, it does obviously put agriculture at risk, but it also gives us an opportunity. It's forcing us to recognize that we should be looking towards home for where our food is coming from much, much more than we have historically, because it's something that's far more in our control. We can't control the wildfires in California. We can't control, but we can look at New York and Long Island and the rest of the state and think about the things that we need to do to protect our growing land and our, you know, and so I'm excited about the fact that, you know, we have, you know, there's no good spin on COVID. It's been so horrible, but it is forcing us to sort of step back and look around and think about what we need to work on and protect and how to care for people and our place a little better. I mean, we've even noticed with climate change here in New York City, we've had restaurants that couldn't open and put our zero waste services on a credit card because they're like, we want to reopen with the right practices in place because we know that the world is burning and we want to be part of the solution. And that for me, I was like, I just was like, wow. You know, working with those smaller businesses that didn't have big budgets that wanted to do the right thing. That was such a, we worked with a high-end restaurant group called Ultima Rea, and they launched with us in the middle of COVID when they couldn't open the restaurant. And it was, we were just, you know, they were doing some takeout, but not a lot. And I was so impressed. It was really, it was awesome.
Yeah. Well, a couple things I wanted to ask you about. My garbage pickup recently told us that they are no longer recycling. They're not even picking up the recycling. They say they have nowhere to bring it to. They're not, you know, and so they're telling us to just throw it in the garbage. And I just have never done that. And it's impossible. So I've been separating it out and taking it out to a dump myself. Mm-hmm. And right now, while my house is under construction, I don't have any place to store all that. Mm-hmm. So I actually have thrown some bottles out this week, and it is so hard and painful to throw something that I know should be recycled into the garbage. Is it true that there's no place for the recycling to go?
There are places for
I know China our waste, which
So yes, China has really closed the door to a lot of our materials, but a big part of that was that our materials were such low quality. I think something that we're grappling with right now is that our waste sector, you know, we sort of made a call in a lot of places that people were not motivated enough to separate their paper from their plastic, from their glass, from their metal. And particularly sticking your paper in with your soda cans and all that stuff, and they get covered in liquid, the paper loses value. I mean, once you have got single stream recycling, you are definitely degrading a lot of the materials. So you look across the world and other countries have 5 streams, 6 streams, 7 streams, and we're trying to shrink the number of recycling streams we have. It's crazy. But it's not just because we think people are lazy. It's also because these waste haulers would like to stick everything in the same damn truck. Because if they're not making a lot of money off of the recycling, they want to cut their costs. So what we're struggling with is that there is a market for good quality paper and cardboard. There's always a market for aluminum cans. Oh my God, they're infinitely recyclable. But if a hauler is taking material to a recycling facility in MRF, that everything is coming together and they don't have the best technology for separation, they're getting poor quality materials, they're going to struggle with finding markets for the stuff. But again, there is always a market for the goods, for the stuff when it's clean and properly separated. And except glass, I would say, is the challenge. There is not always a market, but there are growing markets for glass. There's a ton of work being done where glass is being used in asphalt and other things, but that's been one that most places around the country have been grappling with for a while. But there is a market for good paper, and we're just making
it up. Also because glass is so heavy to ship and stuff. But the other thing that I think we need to do is we need to make a policy that makes it illegal to put like a plastic top on top of a glass bottle so that you can't recycle it, right? You know, so many of those glass, like the olive oils, have that plastic thing on top of the glass bottle and they don't come off. And so it ruins the ability to recycle it.
Anytime something is mixed material, it's problematic. And that you're absolutely right. And I think, but I do think your point is going to a bigger issue with our entire recycling system, is that we've tried to build success off the consumer making the right decision after, you know, with the stuff that they've already bought, as opposed to having producer responsibility to produce things that are readily recyclable. And if not, they should take them back and they should have to deal with them, right? And that's extended producer responsibility. One thing during COVID was that, not during COVID, but before COVID, was there were so many pieces of legislation across the country in different states around extended producer responsibility. And of course, everything got stalled with dealing with crisis. But they're back online and more places are looking at having laws in place. I mean, if you go to Toronto, if you're a business operating in Toronto, you actually pay a fee for the materials that you bring into the market that are not recyclable. So they have they've had extended producer responsibility in place in Ontario for decades. And it's amazing. So we have one client in Toronto that has to, anything that they process themselves or anything that they import, they have to provide an itemized list to Ontario and explain what kind of packaging and how it can be handled and anything that has to be trashed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fee.
Yeah. I mean, so many, like the European Union, you know, you have to have the same plug for all cell phones. I mean, I know this is a different waste stream, but, you know, here, you know, every time Apple comes out with a new phone, they have a new plug that you need. And it's just, you know, we're so pro-business in this country. Anything to help a business make more money as opposed to pro-environment and setting regulations so that all cell phones have to use the same plug, so that they're interchangeable. You don't need a new plug every time you get a new cell phone. You know, it's just, you know, even just how we make products so that they fall apart in a couple of years, so people have to buy it again. I mean, I'm still using my grandmother's mixer, you know, from like 100 years ago. You know, they made things so much better back then. So it's just all frustrating.
My KitchenAid is 30, I'm going to date myself, but it's over 30 years old.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they don't make them like they used to.
It still works, but yeah, we're constantly telling people, if you need a new computer, please get a refurbished one. But you're absolutely right. Things have to be produced so differently.
Yeah. So going back to food, since that's our favorite topic, so many people face difficulties in trying to reduce their food waste. And as a chef, maybe you can share with my listeners, you know, some of the challenges you faced in cooking and buying food for your family and how you minimize waste. Share some of your tips with us.
Sure. So, I mean, with food waste, I mean, the number one thing you can do is plan, right? Think about the meals that you plan to make over the course of the week. Make things you know you might have over a couple days and stick to the plan. If you can't, make things that you can freeze. So if you're not going to, you cook something on Monday and you're not going to eat until Friday, put it in the freezer. You know, if you have vegetables, there are so many things that you can freeze. You can't freeze your lettuce, but pretty much everything else you can freeze if it's starting to turn and save it to use. Even bananas can be frozen for banana bread later. So think about
take the peel off. I'm telling everybody, take the peel off first.
Take the peel off first, stick it in the freezer. But I think planning what you're going to get, because people are so used to, I am going to go shopping for 2 weeks of groceries, or I am going to order 2 weeks of groceries, and fresh produce is not meant to be in the fridge for 2 weeks. Although I do have herbs in my refrigerator and a damp towel that I've had in there for 2 weeks that still look new. So there are things like that you can do, but you really have to, if you're going to get your shelf life stuff and your frozen stuff for 2 weeks, that's great. But buy your produce more frequently. We would tell you to buy it at the farmer's market because we know it's super fresh. You know it's really fresh when you've gotten it and it's going to last longer. It's also way more fun. But so plan and then think about things that you're so used to, like we were saying, the kale stems, you're so used to being, and some recipes recommend that you take the leaves off the stem, but they're edible. If you're roasting your kale, you just need to roast the stems a little longer. So the stems go on the pan, stick them in the oven for 5 minutes, then you can put the leaves in. But there's so much that we are used to wasting. I mentioned juicing because it's a huge pet peeve of mine that so many people have spent millions of dollars on these extraction juicers that remove all the fiber. We need fiber. Fiber is healthy. Fiber is important. We don't just need the sugar and vitamins. We need the whole thing. We need the
right
whole thing. From a family perspective, I think it's, you know, we've just gotten so used to, and there's so many services out there where you can order a different thing for everyone, and you can, and it's all about convenience and satisfaction and making it easy. But, you know, aside from the packaging of ordering all of these pre-prepared different items, there is definitely something to be said for having a family meal together and everyone eating the same thing and the kids having to try something that maybe isn't their favorite. And so one of the things that we saw a lot of during COVID, restaurants that did a lot of takeout started to think really creatively because they weren't just serving the lunch crowd of a person coming down from an office. They were serving families. So they really converted to more of a family style ordering service where, okay, we're going to get chicken for everyone. We're going to get a vegetable side. It cut the number of containers down and, you know, you're fitting more food into one container. It's less plastic waste. Ideally, we move to reusable containers, but in the meantime, it also, it will reduce waste because when everyone gets lots of different things, you find that there's just more waste. So I would say if you tend to work with a meal service or order from a particular restaurant and they don't offer family style, ask them. But we definitely encourage like cooking on the weekends, planning for your week, and then making sure that you build into your schedule. If I bought produce on Saturday, I'm going to go back out on Wednesday. And that will definitely cut your food waste.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Again, you've traveled to Europe, people shop daily, you know, they just stop at their local stores on their way home. And what do I need today? You know, they don't buy for so many days. And I like that. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to feel like eating 5 days from now. You know, it's like, I'm really, as a foodie, I'm kind of like an emotional eater. So I like, I'm in the mood for, you know, Italian, or I'm in the mood for, you know, Indian. And so you know, my pantry items are fine because they're stable. They're there. But for the fresh stuff, you know, it's really makes sense to stop on your way home and support your, you know, small local family business as opposed to, you know, trying to buy all your fresh produce at Costco, which I do sometimes, I must say. But, do what you can and support your local people. Talking about local, I'm sure you heard what happened last week for New York and all of Northeast dairy farmers. They were notified by Dannon or Horizon Organics that they are no longer going to be offering, they are no longer going to be purchasing the milk from these farmers. And all of a sudden, with just, I guess it's a year's notice, but that's not a lot of time to rethink about where you're going to sell all of your thousands and thousands of gallons of milk. You know, there's over 90 farmers that were just kind of cut from the Horizon food stream. And I think that's one of the problems when we have a food system where you have these big conglomerates that, you know, buy up the small people and then they can just discard you like you're trash. Any ideas about, you know, how the dairy farmers can come back from that or another stream for them?
You know, I think when, you know, this was also when we were working on the farm to institution work at the state, so much of the story was that all of these, you know, these mid-sized farmers had grocery store markets. They had so many markets that just went away. Because like you said, these companies get purchased, the grocery chains get purchased, and then they have to buy from certain producers and the markets just shifted and they lost so much. And I feel like so many of our dairy farmers, New York isn't full of a bunch of CAFOs, you know, so many of these are really mid-size to smaller in the scheme of the world farms.
Right.
And they need those, they need regional markets. So I think, you know, the same way that we were thinking about produce when I was at the state, we were working so hard to get some of these vegetables into the school system, but also to create infrastructure for processing and distribution. And I think it's the same for dairy, where we need to be really thinking about regional infrastructure and opportunities. You know, you had groups like Chobani and we just have so much yogurt now, you know, they've opened up plants in other parts of the country. And so, you know, they've expanded elsewhere, not necessarily in New York. I think looking at how we build up those kinds of businesses, but how we move more of that dairy into the school system, into institutions, into hospitals, into just, you know, we ensure that any organization that receives any public money is not buying from Danone and Horizon, right? They are buying from some source that is ensuring that that milk was grown here, because there is no excuse.
Well, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with this, with New York State. New York State has an incentive for schools to purchase from New York State. And if you do that, you actually can save 25% on your reimbursement. Well, on Long Island, we had no access for any milk from New York State. The milk that we could get was coming from New Jersey. We had no viable stream to bring in milk. And that was the only way we were going to get our volume up to the amount that we needed to reach in order to get that discount or that incentive. And it was so frustrating. Our hands were tied.
This is a perfect time to revisit that conversation, right? Because now you have a market, you have a supply desperate for a market. And Long Island's a big market. That's a very dense, you know, it's a lot of schools.
So I hope they're thinking like that. I mean, I personally am no longer there. So, but, you know, hopefully the Secretary of Agriculture, Commissioner Ball, is thinking in that way. And
I'm sure he is. I
mean, try to figure out another market. Yeah,
I'm sure Richard is losing a lot of sleep right now. On that.
I'm sure too. So we are almost out of time, Christina. Is there anything that I haven't touched on that you'd like to share with my audience before we run out of time?
You know, I think the fact that your audience is listening to you means that they're thinking about these things all the time, which is really wonderful. You know, in terms of what people can do at home, obviously.
Of course, we're preaching to the choir.
Preaching to the choir, but reducing your food waste, thinking about reusable dishware, you know, your to-go mugs, your, you know, one thing that happened with COVID is there was a flood of misinformation at the start because people didn't know about service transmission and it's Starbucks and everyone stopped accepting reusable to-go containers. And all of the science from the CDC and others has proven that
reusable bags.
There are no concerns, and there's a lot right now of like surface cleaning theater to make people feel better. But reusable dishware, particularly if you're in a corporate environment and you're getting it with your lunch and it's been washed in the dishwasher, is going to be as safe, if not safer, than disposables. But also, there are simple procedures for your coffee shop to take your mug back. So, so when you're, if you go places and they say, no, we won't use your reusable dishware, you can say, well, Starbucks is now accepting to-go mugs again. So you should too. And when you go to, grocery stores and other places, there are lots of places that will allow you to bring a container for bulk food and other things. So we're all eating about a credit card in microplastics every single week, because there's so much plastic in our environment, the fish we eat everywhere.
Isn't that unbelievable?
It's disgusting. It's awful. It's awful. And we don't.
I know.
We know this is not good for us. So if we need to get rid of packaging and disposable. So I would say, you know, that's a biggie.
Thank you. Well, Christina, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
You too.
And everyone, thank you for joining. I've really missed doing this show over the summer, and I'm really glad to be back. So everyone, have a great rest of the week. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you all next week. Bye for now.